wellness. Senator Morissette is here tonight to see him. Oh, great. And so we'll open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 364A. Senator Morissette, come on up. Andy.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 364A is a measure that would establish a mental health consumer advisory council to advise the director of DHS on the provision of mental health services. It would also require DHS to develop a policy that supports and promotes self-determination, and it would require that at least 20% of the membership of all task forces, commissions, advisory groups, and committees established by a public body in relating to persons with mental health or addiction issues be consumers of mental health or addiction services.
Okay. Senator Morissette, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, Springfield, represents Lane and Lane County, parts of. That was a very good description of the bill, and it is a very simple bill, yet there are some glitches that we're working on, and I would like to have my trusty legislative assistant, Don Bischoff, say a few words about the amendments.
Good morning, Chair, committee members. We just got the amendments back literally 10 minutes ago. And I think they solved the problems with the bill, but there may be a misplaced and, I'm still trying to figure that out. The bill was part of a two-part package that was requested by a mental health self-help peer group in Eugene, or in Springfield, sorry, called SAFE Incorporated. And a representative from that group, Drake Eubank, may be here to testify on this morning, plans to be here to testify on it. 364 might be described as mental health light. We also introduced Senate Bill 363, which would have created the Office of Mental Health Ombudsman, which was passed out of committee but sent to Ways and Means and awaits an uncertain fate, because he wanted to get a couple of the important parts other than the ombudsman into law. He also requested we introduce Senate Bill 364. The A engrossed versions is in front of you today. That simply codifies what is already largely present practice in DHS, as I think you'll hear from a department representative this morning. Bob Nicholas had an informal consumer advisory council functioning for some time. This simply puts the advisory council into statute. And it also would put into statute a requirement that any time there is a public body dealing with mental health services to mental health consumers, that at least 20% of that body would be made up of mental health consumers. There was a concern on the department level that the wording of the A engrossed version would require them to open up literally every committee, including those at the state hospital, which might be dealing with specific treatment plans for specific patients, and they would not necessarily want other patients as members of that committee. So the amendments you have before you today are intended to make it clear that this would refer to task forces, commissions, advisory groups, and committees that are as referred to in 192.630, which is the public meetings law. So in other words, it would only be public committees that this requirement would apply to. I haven't figured out whether the and is in the right place in that amendment yet, but that's certainly the intent. The other part of the amendment was requested by the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, which wanted to be sure that the special concerns about mental health for senior citizens were addressed in any of these committees. They have pushed through a couple of sessions now some legislation to require DHS to give special attention to the mental health needs of senior citizens, which are somewhat different than those of the population at large. So the reference to age balance in there is in as a compromise with the request of what the Governor's Commission on Senior Services requested.
Thank you, Mr. Bischoff. Any questions of either of these two? Yes.
Madam Chair, I do.
Olson.
Don, I guess I'm a little confused here. I was thinking that as I was studying this, and from the knowledge that I have, that DHS already had a policy in place that kind of dealt with this. That's not true?
Let me... I'm sorry.
Okay, so...
Thank you for that question. I was just going to refer to this. I know that there is a concern that proposed bills are redundant and that they're already covered. Part of the problem is that some legislative language is not specific and some areas do not follow the intent of a statute, and they don't always do this. And the purpose of this bill is to make it more specific and make sure that they do follow a procedure. And that is, I think, a valid reason to put something in statute, is to make sure that it's clear and make sure that it will be followed. And I think Representative Cowan went through this in another bill that we had in another committee. So I don't think this is a I don't think it's a needless redundancy. I think it is important, and I think we'll have some testimony to that.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Maurer.
Thank you. I guess I'm a bit confused about why in 24 and the use of the word committees, and I missed what you said about the concern that this might apply to groups that really would be inappropriate. And so, you know, when you use the term public body is a pretty wide swath. And there may be times when a committee, it would not be appropriate to go look for a consumer when an agenda topic is regarding mental health services. Or
Chair, to me, Representative Maurer, I'm not sure I can think of any that would, any of the public committees is defined by the public meetings law. I'm not, and if they're going to be relating to services to mental health consumers, then I think it would be appropriate, and I think the backers of this bill can speak a little more to that, that it would be appropriate that the 20% rule would apply there. The department seems comfortable with this. They'll speak to that in their testimony. So I think it's simply a matter that for a long time, people who define themselves as mental health services consumers have felt that the policies and treatments and so forth that are designed for them are frequently designed without legitimate input from people who are either receiving services or who have received services, have a lot of experience to offer to any committee that's going to be dealing with these services, and that's why they attempted to put this in. But we certainly did not intend that it would cover any staff committees, any in-house agency committees, and that's why we asked Legislative Council to come up with the language that they did, which would make it clear that they're only talking about public committees and those dealing specifically with services to mental health consumers.
And a follow-up. The League of Cities and Association of Oregon Counties, have they weighed in on this?
I don't, Representative Maurer, I don't believe we've heard from them at all on this topic. The bill did receive hearings in the Senate, and we've not had any communication that I'm aware of from either AOC or LOC, and we're in frequent communication with those folks on a number of issues.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Any further questions? Okay. Is this the amendment that you've given us, the dash 3 amendment, is that the amendment that you want us to forward on?
Chair Tomei, yes it is. If I can figure out if the and is in the right place in line 4 of the amendment. The intent is that it would modify all of those groups, any of those groups that are subject to ORS 192630, which is the public meetings law.
Okay. Okay, so let's read through that. Except as otherwise provided by law, at least 20% of the membership of all task forces, commissions, advisory groups, and committees established by a public body is defined in ORS 174, and then we insert subject to ORS 19230. What is 19230?
That's the, Chair Tomei, that's the Oregon Public Meetings Law, which defines public bodies that are subject to all the rules of opening their sessions to the public.
So we no longer have, or do we have, relating to persons with mental health and addiction?
Chair Tomei, yes, I believe you still do. You're inserting in there as a qualifier the public bodies, both those that are defined by ORS 174109 and also subject to ORS 192630, and then it picks up with the rest of the sentence.
And related persons with mental health or addiction issues shall be consumers.
Yes.
And then on page 2, we're going to add with representation balanced according to age.
That's correct.
So your intent is that any issues dealing with mental health issues should have between that 20% of the task force, commission, advisory groups, et cetera, should be consumers, and that also that it will be balanced according to age.
The specific language we ask for from Ledge Council, I don't know if you've had this experience this session, but we don't always get what we ask for from Ledge Council.
I think there's a song about that.
I believe the phrase was with consideration to a balance according to age.
With consideration to? Okay. All right. Any other questions of these folks? Yes, Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize, I was a few minutes late, so you might have covered this. Good morning, gentlemen. Section 3, is this applying to counties as well? Because, or is this only applying to the state? The reason I ask that is, I wouldn't be opposed to that necessarily. The definition of public bodies is local. And if you take this all by itself, it could mean that any kind of public meeting task force at the local level would have to have 20% consumer membership if it's mental health and A&D. Is that how you read it?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, that is how we read it, and that was the intent of the folks who asked for this, because so many of the important decisions about these services do get made at the local level, and I think Gina Nicol perhaps can speak to that when she testifies.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Madam Chair, is
yes.
this one
of Mauer.
Go. Okay. Sorry, Madam Chair. Is my concern is that a public body is going to not know about this law and hold have a committee, most likely, and not realize this law was there, and then have significant negative consequences because they didn't have this representation. And I'm not worried about a county mental health department because they're in the loop. But I'm talking about a school board, a county agency, things that are kind of tangential to the direct delivery of mental health services that somehow this can be used against them and open themselves to litigation, or when clearly they were not intending to exclude anybody. And
Chair Tomei, Representative Mauer, I think most public bodies have staff attorneys who are charged with keeping them up to date on what the changes in the law are affecting them. I'm trying to think. I think school districts in particular would be sensitive to this and would be become aware of this law once it goes into effect. I think there's an attempt on the local level, for example, and again, Gina Nicol can perhaps speak to this, for coordination with all the bodies that are involved in services to people with mental illness or mental problems of various types. I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer to that.
And we do have somebody in the audience, okay. I think, who can answer these. But excellent question, Representative. Any other questions for Mr. Bischoff? And we do have other people coming to testify. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I'm Senator Walker is here, and I think what I'm going to do is close the public hearing on Senate Bill 364 and open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 379A. Representative Walker, or Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to invite up Jim Green and Tricia Smith, if I might. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. Thank you for taking me out of order. I was in another committee testifying, and I have to be on the floor in 10 minutes, so this will be brief. This is a bill that we all worked on last session, and it came about as a result of the serious child abuse cases that we found out about last session in Salem-Keizer School District. The music teacher was later convicted of abusing four girls and over a long period of time, and no one seemed to know about it. So we passed legislation last session that required school districts to disclose public records, disciplinary records of convicted teachers, so that people out here in the community could find out what went wrong, why the school district didn't spot this sooner and take care of it. We had a little fix-it to that bill this session. I believe that's passed both chambers now. And this was the other piece of that last session. This requires school districts to provide a training to their staff, all of their staff. The training that you get, I'm not sure you get that training. We do in the Senate because I insisted on it. It took a while. But you're a mandatory reporter, and you have no idea what you're supposed to do as a mandatory reporter unless you get the kind of training that tells you what to look for and who to call and what to do. So we now have training, and this is all I'm asking for, is that school districts provide that kind of training to their personnel. And it is it got stuck in fiscal last year, and I'm not sure why, and just everything split apart down there, as you know. The atom bomb went off. There is no fiscal. The fiscal would be on any of the school districts, but as Mr. Green will tell you, most of them do some sort of training, and it's very simple. They can do a video. They can do all kinds of things, but some districts don't. So this is simply requiring that all districts do this. It's a good child safety protection measure, and I appreciate that you've heard this bill today. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions of Senator Walker? Representative Kote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Walker, for bringing this bill forward. And we have not had our training yet, so I'm looking forward to it. But
I'm sorry to hear that, Madam
Chair.
They've
been trying to schedule it, apparently, and it's running.
Oh, you know, Madam Chair and Representative Kote, I found it extremely valuable for me. And even we had it last year, and we had it again this session. Mm-hmm. And I actually learned something else new this session. So while you may think you know everything about it, there are new things to learn all the time. And I think it's extremely valuable to at least know what are those first steps. You see something happening in your neighborhood or in the grocery store. What do? I don't know. I'm a mandatory reporter. What does that mean? I don't know. Nobody's ever told me what to do. So that's a broader issue that I'm trying to address about how to make sure that all mandatory reporters under the statute get some kind of training. But this is at least a little piece.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you, Senator Walker. I know that you do. You want to stay on as we?
Actually, if you have no further questions, I'd like to
scoot. Further questions of Senator Walker? All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I know Mr. Green will stay in line.
Great. Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent the 20,000 school employees working and represented by Oregon School Employees Association. We work in Head Start Association's K-12 and ESD districts and community colleges, as well as park and recreation districts and libraries. I'm here in strong support of Senate Bill 379 this session. Last session, we worked very hard with Senator Walker to pass her legislation dealing with how school districts deal with potential abuse in their schools. Because my members are very concerned about child abuse, they see it more perhaps than any other group of folks in the state. When you think about who sees kids, it's my folks. They see them every day. And if there is a child out there that's being abused, they're likely going to see that. Now, whether or not they know what they're looking at is another issue. As Senator Walker said, and as you know, since you're mandatory reporters and have not received training, it's very interesting how our statutes are mixed in whether or not they require training of mandatory reporters. I think it's interesting, was interesting to be told that attorneys, who are also mandatory reporters, are required to get 3 hours of CLE every year in child abuse identification and notification. Now, my folks aren't required to get any training at all, ever, on this issue. So how can we expect them to know what they're looking at and know what to do when they see it? This is a very important bill, and we really ask your support to strongly move it out and look at this, if you can, in all the other areas. I know that we will be able to better respond to the things that my members see in the schools every day with this bill. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Jim, why don't you go ahead, and then we'll save our questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. Like Ms. Smith, I've worked with Senator Walker on this issue over the last two biennia, and we're here in full support of Senate Bill 379. Some folks question me about why would we support this. It looks like a mandate on school districts. It looks like there'd be additional costs for school districts. Actually, there isn't. If you take a look at the programs that are around the state, and I have some experience in this, my brother is a detective with Clackamas County, and his area of expertise is child abuse investigation. And he does trainings for the several school districts in Clackamas County on this as part of an intergovernmental agreement between Clackamas County and the school districts. My brother indicates it takes about 2 hours for him to come into the North Clackamas School District and do the teachers in their school district. This would be to every school district. Now, if they wanted to go that in depth and have a detective come in and do it, they can do that. The Department of Human Services also has a videotape that they've prepared and provide it free to school districts and other individuals who are mandatory reporters on the issues of child abuse. What to look for, what happens when child abuse occurs, who do you have to report it to? Just those minimal things are the necessary training that school employees need. I talked to several school districts about this. They're very supportive of this. We have numerous school districts across the state that are doing this now. Education Service Districts, our ESDs, are also interested in partnering with our school districts to provide this training to those rural, more spread out school districts so that when they have those in-service days, they'll be able to provide the training. They are in full support of this. This is about child safety. This is to make sure that when kids are in an abusive situation, that they get out of that situation as soon as they can and that they are identified and things happen as they're supposed to happen. One of the things also that I want to point out to you is Salem Kaiser has done an extensive training program within the last year and a half. They've gone to what I would call the Cadillac plan of doing training for their school employees, and that's one level you could do. At minimal, we would like to see at least the DHS tape in our school districts for our school employees so that these kids, if they're in an abusive situation, can get out of it. And it also protects some of the liability of school districts. We do have mandatory reporters in every one of our buildings, and if something were to go on and they didn't report, it creates a liability issue for the school district, as you probably read in newspapers across the state. So we're very supportive of this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Any questions of these two?
Madam Chair. I would like to add one thing, if I could. I didn't mention this earlier, but Senator Walker talked about the experience that we had in Salem Kaiser a few years ago with one of the music teachers. I have a child in Salem Kaiser, and music is his life, and this was one of his teachers. The abuse that occurred in the school system didn't only occur to the children that teacher abused. The trauma occurred to every child that he taught, because they loved him. And when they found out what happened, it devastated them, and they didn't know what to do about it. The music program in North Salem still suffers as a result of the ripple effect of that abuse. This is a very important bill, and it will help all those children. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the information, and I do consider the training really important. I wondered if you could explain to me the item in section 4, number 7, on page 4, beginning with line 22, that talks about reporting back, and I wondered if you could give us some information on the reasoning there.
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, that was put in, and there was great discussion last biennium and during the interim on this issue of when someone makes a report, How do they know what happened? If and I'm a mandatory reporter in the state. I'm an attorney in the state of Oregon, so I'm a mandatory reporter. If I call DHS and, or local law enforcement and I say, I believe this has gone on, and I want to find out what happened with that report, did they do an investigation? Was there child abuse found? Was there court orders? Did something occur? That's what this Section 4, Subsection 7 is about. And this is language that Senator Walker worked very closely with DHS on. Because if you read it, it says, when the department completes an investigation under this section, the department shall make diligent efforts to notify the person who made the report of child abuse to the department about the outcome of the investigation. It's a loop-back procedure. So that the individual, if at all possible, from the department's viewpoint, can get that information, it lets them know what happened with that investigation.
Follow up. Thank you. I apologize then for not bringing it up while Senator Walker was here. I didn't want to keep her. I guess I'd be interested in knowing if we're going to hear any testimony from the department. I'm concerned about confidentiality issues and whether that's appropriate or not.
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, I believe there is a representative from DHS in the room that can speak to that. And it was a long negotiation between DHS and Senator Walker on the language that's in that portion. And I believe you'll hear from the representative from DHS that they believe the language lets them do the job they need to do, do the investigation, and to do as much as they can to notify the person who made the report. But I believe they'll tell you that the language now is what they wanted in the bill.
Thank you.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, I'm just curious, what is Salem doing, Salem-Keizer, if they're doing the Cadillac? I mean, at what level? I'm just kind of curious.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I'll give you a flavor of what they're doing. They've brought in experts from law enforcement and from DHS and from different agencies, and they do trainings in their, what they call their curriculum boundaries, in their high school curriculum boundaries. And they bring in elementary folks, they bring in their middle school folks, they bring in their high school folks, and it is part of an intensive, almost full-day training on the issue. They were obviously one of the issues that brought this bill forward, and they do an extensive training program with their staff. And from their human resource director at Salem-Keizer Public Schools, I've heard that the staff really responds to this training. They didn't understand what duty they had. They now understand that it's a very, you know, very high-level duty of protecting kids beyond what they had as just a school employee. But they come in and they do almost a full-day training with their staff on child abuse, how to identify it, what to do once you identify it, how you respond, what's the policies and procedures in place that the Salem-Keizer School District now has to report child abuse. Representative Kotek, when we started down this line, And the superintendent from the North Clackamas School District, Ron Naso, came in and explained that a lot of his staff originally thought if they told his or her principal that they believed child abuse was going on, they thought their responsibility was done. If you, in fact, read the law, that's not where the responsibility ends. That may be in school district policy. You need to tell your building level supervisor, but the law, as a mandatory reporter, requires you to report it to either DHS or law enforcement. And so they go through that entire process of what their policy says in the school district and what the law says, and then bring in folks like my brother who understand child abuse and start to really recognize some of the effects of it on kids and help their staff recognize those things.
The other thing that Salem-Keizer does is they offer child abuse recognition training to parents and volunteers. And they publicized that offering quite extensively to parents of students.
Wow. And Madam Chair, Representative Kosek, you'll notice in the bill that's also a requirement in here. If you take a look on page 2 of the bill, on lines 3 through 6, an educational provider shall make the training provided, that's the training that we would provide to our staff in our schools, available each year to parents and legal guardians of children who attend a school operated by the educational provider. That's part of the law, and that's something that we agreed to. We believe parents and legal guardians ought to have that same experience and training that the staff has.
That's great. Thank you.
Any further questions?
Sure.
Representative Olson.
Questions for both of you. And my approach on this is, my perspective is considering this as a redundancy, because I've checked with several of my school districts down there in the Albany area and everything, and they actually have policies already in place that are dealing specifically with making that available to parents if they'd like to attend, but also twice a year going through all this starting with the administrative, going through the staff. My first question is, Tricia, you mentioned in your testimony that it's not required of your people that you represent.
The training.
Right.
Yes.
I understand it's not, but I'm curious, what's the percentage of them that do receive the training because of policies that are in place?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, I'm sorry I can't answer your question. I've not done a survey of districts to know how many do and how many don't. But we expect that just in the last couple of years or two or three years since these very highly publicized cases have occurred and the districts involved were left kind of holding the bag because they didn't have policies. I think districts, and probably guided by OSCA, have been encouraged to adopt them. What this bill does is make sure they all have them.
Okay, thank you. I follow up, Madam Chair.
What?
Jim, for you, didn't Salem already have a policy in place regarding this?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, they did have a policy in place regarding this. They didn't have the extensive training that they currently have in place. And I believe prior to the issue that brought about this in the Salem Kaiser School District, their training was pretty minimal, and it wasn't to all school employees at the time.
Okay. Yeah, I just have one additional question now. Thank you. The issue with the bill as I read it and the responsibility of DHS to keeping the parties informed who reported this, advised of what the investigation is and everything. Doesn't DHS already do that?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, I'd really like to have the representative from DHS answer that question. There was a long negotiation that went on with regard to this bill on the Senate side, mm-hmm. and there were email traffic back and forth between DHS and Senator Walker to make sure that this language was accurate. And actually, Representative Olson, the state police and police agencies mm-hmm. became involved in this negotiation because originally it had included them as well, and my brother even brought this forward saying that could compromise the investigation. If we give out information beyond what we would normally do in our lines of investigation and questioning and bringing witnesses forward, we don't want to compromise those investigations. So that's why the language is the way it is in Section 4, Subsection 7.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you. I see Bill Fluting, and I think somebody from DHS is here. Please come up. Pardon? You snooze, you lose.
Madam Chair, I would ask that Jim Green remain because I have a question for him regarding another bill. So.
Oh, that I remain in the room,
yes.
Not at the table.
Yeah.
Do not leave the building.
Good. Do not leave the building. Please come up.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. I'll address the questions that I heard regarding Senate Bill 379 and the reporting loop.
But first, identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Una Swanson, and I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for the Department of Human Services.
So, thank you.
And, yes, we have worked with Senator Walker on the language, and I'll explain to you as the language exists. I think one of the questions was, does DHS do this already? And one of the concerns that was expressed by Senator Walker is that it's being done but inconsistently. And a concern for teachers was that they might have reported abuse about a child in their classroom, and it certainly would be concerning to have the child back and not know exactly where the investigation ended. So in this regard, it requires the department to make a diligent effort to get back to that reporting party and to provide some information that will let them know to the degree that it's necessary for them to know, to the degree that it's helpful for them to know, that either that we did a face-to-face contact with that family and give them information about whether a service is going to be provided or whether there was not an issue. And I'd like to clarify, I thought that Representative Cowan's question or concern was a very good one. We're still in a position not to violate the confidentiality of those families that we do investigations on, and we've worked with RAG on this language, and it really is a matter of getting back to that reporter and I think honoring the responsibility they took on by calling us and letting them know that we made a contact and to the degree we can, in what way they could expect that child safety to have been addressed without violating confidentiality.
Thank you. Any questions of Ms. Watson?
Okay.
Could you say,
Una?
Sure. Thank you. Go ahead. Can I identify yourself, please?
Madam Chair, to main committee for the record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. But today I'm here on behalf of myself as a grandparent. This is a very serious issue. Even with the rules that we have in place today, there's cracks in that boardwalk that people fall through. I'll give you an example. My two grandkids have put up with this their whole life. It's documented. As recently as the 205 session, with the help of Representative Boquist and his staff, they personally had to go to the Department of Human Services in Dallas and walk into the office and confront the folks that work there. And an uncovered mess. I hate this word confidentiality. As a grandparent, we could see this going on. My son fought this, but he was powerless. It finally cost a divorce in the family. My granddaughter is now 12, my grandson's 8. Now, we haven't heard a thing in the last year because in the last 3 years, I quit asking them, how is things at home with your mother? It brought tears to them, and finally just a wall of silence. The sheriff's office has been involved. The courts were involved. Psychiatrists were involved. And nothing has really helped. The last case that we know of, the last case my son heard about, was 3 days after the problem, if you want to call it that. The mother threw a glass pop bottle across the room and hit my granddaughter in the back of the head. When she went to school the next day, she had this bruise. The teacher caught it and asked her what happened. She informed the teacher exactly what had happened. But what did the teacher do? She called the mother. So you can imagine what happened when them kids went home. My son didn't find out about this till he picked him up for his weekend. Even after all his 3 years of trials and divorce proceedings, the judge decided it's best if the kids remain with the mother. Well, you know what happens to these kids are abused from the day they're born? A very large percentage of them turn into abusers themselves, and I can see it in these two kids. This rule is not strong enough. Things like this shouldn't happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cluding. So sorry about your problems with your family. Any questions of Mr. Cluding? We want to wait a minute, see if we have any questions here. Okay, thank you so much for testifying. I think Representative Cowan brings up a good question about confidentiality. And Ms. Watson, what you seem to be saying is somewhat different from what the amendment says. That quoting on page 4, line 22, when the department completes an investigation, la, 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 it shall make diligent efforts to notify the person who made the report of child abuse to the department about the outcome of the investigation. And I'm hearing you say, Representative Cowan, that in many cases that may not be appropriate because of confidentiality concerns. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem that this says you will do that. It doesn't say if that's appropriate in regard to confidentiality of the child or the family.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, that's a really good question. What the language says is that the department will provide information about the outcome of the investigation. And in giving information about the outcome of the investigation, we can let the mandatory reporter know whether the issue that was reported was founded, we're providing services, or the issue that was reported was not found to be the case. Excuse me, and we're not providing services. What would be protected by confidentiality then would be the detail of the interviews and the way in which we learned about how safety threats might be occurring in that family and any additional information. This would simply be the outcome is that what you reported to us we're addressing with through services, or what you reported we did not find to be the case. And as we've worked with RAG, we have found that's within our discretion to share.
Ms. Swanson, but it's not just mandatory reporters. It could be the person next door,
certainly,
lady down the street. So you would be, according to this, you would be required to report to those people also the outcome, correct?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, that's correct. This addresses all reporters.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If a reporter gets back the information that the case was unfounded for abuse, and we've had discussions in this committee before that unfounded for abuse does not necessarily mean that abuse is not occurring. It could mean that there's someone else available in the home or some way to address that abusive situation in the home to keep the child safe. Is there a way in providing that information back in terms of unfounded to not be diseducating people about what kinds of instances they should be reporting? So if they hear back it was unfounded, will they then understand that what they witnessed, what they saw, was not something that should have concerned them?
Chair Tomei and Representative Gelser, I'd just like to clarify that when we say it's unfounded, it means that we found no indication that what was reported was true based on the information that we could gather in the course of the assessment. So I think that that's I'd just like to ask an additional question. Is that your understanding? Or it sounds like you're saying that what you understand is if we say it's unfounded, we're saying that maybe there was abuse?
May I clarify? I think my understanding, and from conversations we've had, and certainly another bill that we've worked on, that just because a case is unfounded, sometimes a case might be unfounded because it's not possible to decisively prove that the injuries or the harm were caused by abuse. But certainly there are children that are being abused for whom the department is unable to determine a founded case of abuse. That doesn't mean those kids are not being abused. And my concern is that if someone has made a report, they hear back from the Department of Human Services that it was unfounded for abuse, and the child continues to endure injury or abuse, might that person stop reporting because they now believe that what's happening is not considered to be abuse, rather than the difference that it wasn't able to be decisively proven to be abuse?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, we have three different determinations that we make on our dispositions. One of them is unfounded, and that means that through the course of our investigation, we found no information to support that abuse or neglect was occurring. We have a determination that's unable to determine, and it means that there appeared to be some indication of abuse, but we could not find reasonable cause to believe there was abuse, and that may be closer to what Representative Gelser is sing, and then we have a founded, which means that there's reasonable cause to believe that abuse occurred. And I think that whenever we report back to a mandatory reporter or other reporter, again, I want to say that in reporting back to them, the information we're able to share with them will be limited based on the confidentiality of the situation, but I think we always tell reporters, call us. If you're concerned, call us, and we'll work with you to determine if this is something that we need to go out on again. So I think that that would certainly be the message. We wouldn't want to leave a person. People who in good faith make reports of child abuse are doing the right thing. And if we go out and don't find that there's abuse and have no reasonable cause to support that, at the same time, we know that person made that call in good faith, trying to keep a child safe, and we'd encourage them to do the same thing again. So I hope that's the information that you're looking for.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you so much, Ms. Swanson. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 379A. And it seemed to me we were having testimony on...
started on 364.
Okay, 364. So we will open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 364A, and Bob Dundiff and Michael Morris.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Mike Morris, and I'm the Quality Improvement and Certification Manager for the Department of Human Services Addiction and Mental Health Division. And I'm here to testify in support of 364A. We strongly support consumer involvement in our various committees. We value their input and has believe that since they are the ones, the recipients of the care, that they should be involved in the policy and treatment discussions. So we do support that aspect of the bill. In regards to the Consumer Advisory Committee, as said in the written testimony, Bob Nickel, when he came into his position, almost immediately called a consumer survivor advisory group that he meets with regularly. And we believe that this is such a valuable committee that establishing it in statute would be important at some point when Bob Nickel decides to retire, that committee continues. We have worked with the proponents of the bill to address a couple of concerns, and that is in regards to our internal staff committees and wanting to make sure that the 20% does not apply to those. There are some of those committees that where they're
wondering. Let me stop you there. So how in the bill are you addressing that?
How in the bill, in the amendment, the proposed amendment that was discussed earlier.
So we don't have that amendment. That's something that's coming?
No, that is, we worked with Senator Morissette's office regarding the amendment, and that was an amendment that was brought forward this morning already.
So show me in this amendment how that eliminates your concerns about other staff meetings.
Well, it has to do with...
the ORS 192-63?
Yes, right, okay. In regards to the public body. We have not had a chance to look at that particular statute to make sure that, but it appears to remove our concern regarding this applying to staff internal operations committees.
Okay,
so.
Mike, please continue. I'm sorry, I interrupted
you. That's okay. And so Anyway, and then the other is we do support the inclusion of the language that is also in that amendment that came forward this morning to make sure that there is representation from the various age groups that we serve, in particular the older adults that oftentimes are not included in discussions. So we support that. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer those questions.
Representative Maurer, you had asked a question about whether or not this would be subject to county and city committees, et cetera, and commissions. Would they be subject to this law? Do you want to follow up on that?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Please do.
The intent of the bill is fine. The issue or the unintended consequences. And I'm not worried about the Department of Mental Health, and I'm not worried about a county mental health department. What I'm concerned about are other public, just the whole general form of public bodies. And I'm probably not going to talk about an irrigation district, but clearly school boards deal with mental health issues tangential to their daily work. And so, and that's why I was going to, and I'm glad Jim Green was here so that he could either address a concern or alleviate that concern that this would, you know, may have an unintended consequence, and maybe the amendment, the 192.630, would address that. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, but again, we want to avoid that unintended consequence that really is not truly the intent of the bill.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, and again, also I am not an attorney, but as I read this in regards to Section 3, Line 25, it talks about those public body, well, with the amendment, would be a public body committee or advisory group or commission appointed by a public body that is relating to persons with mental health and addiction issues. So it seems to be, would apply to those committees that would entail discussions and be focusing in on services to individuals with mental health and addiction services. So.
Follow up, Representative?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The other question is, define consumer. I mean, you probably could easily, you know, the legislative body probably has more than 20% consumers, you know, loosely defined. So how do we define what a consumer is?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, this is an issue that has been discussed before, and you, Bob Junta, may be able to even further comment on it. Frequently, what consumers of mental health services oftentimes will use the term self-identified mental health consumer. And so I think for the purposes of this bill, they would need to be self-identified as a mental health consumer to fit into that 20%.
And then one last follow-up, and that would be how do you advertise for consumers? How do you go out and get them? You know, and in some cases they clearly self-identify, but there may be times when that isn't as clear.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, there are a growing number of mental health consumer advocacy groups that have been forming, and frequently we will go to those groups and request that they direct us or seek their assistance in identifying individuals to serve on committees and commissions.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Representative Maurer is raising a good point. I guess the way I'm looking at this is, if a school district or some other not governmental body decided to have a committee specifically on this topic, then they would be required to do the 20%. I think if there was a random school committee that happened to touch on this issue, I don't think they would. The relating to part seems important. A task force relating to this issue. So I don't know if that helps, but that's how I'm looking at this. But it's a good point. I mean, it's a big requirement for every committee, but I don't think that's the case if we look at the relating clause.
Representative Geltzer.
be happy to be represented, but I'm not, alas. I just wanted to thank you. I wanted to put on the record, I have a constituent to whom this bill is very important and has made many contacts to my office, and the reason for that has been she is so impacted by the decisions and the recommendations that often come from these task forces that she feels that it's very important that her perspective as someone that has been hospitalized, as someone that has been a consumer of many of these kinds of services, be reflected. And I know that it's the practice generally of these task forces, and I think DHS does a pretty good job of trying to bring consumers in, and I wouldn't want this bill to suggest that DHS had not been a good actor in this in terms of being inclusive and bringing people in, but it makes sense to me on its face. And I think in terms of the school board issue, again, that related to mental health and addictions, but I do think that it would make sense at a local school district level. I know certainly as I watch decisions be made and task forces be formed to look at issues related to special education or alternative education, it was always curious to me that there was not sometimes any representation from families that were parenting these children, and I think that that's a very important perspective to be added to those groups. So while I don't think that this applies directly to school districts, I don't think it would be a bad thing if a school district was appointing a task force to look at mental health and addiction issues within their school district and among their student population, to be including people that had experience in that area and people who were living with the consequences of those challenges.
You bring up an excellent point, but then as I look on the new, on page 2, the new line 1, I guess, with representation balanced according to age, so if you're dealing with school-age children, why would you want to balance it with elderly representatives?
Madam Chair, I think that you would want to balance it between first graders and 12th graders. I mean, there's your scope of age could be different. I think probably you wouldn't have first graders or 12th graders. Well, maybe 12th graders, but you wouldn't have first graders or 6th graders. You would probably have their parents.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I know we're getting, you know, this is kind of misdirecting the bill, because I know where the bill is directed, and I guess the question still remains, you know, if it's an issue about children's mental health and it's a school board task force or committee, it's probably not always appropriate to have, quote, the consumer, the family. Is the parent isn't the consumer, truly. It is the student. And they may not have a legal standing to be there. So, I mean, that's just... It depends on how the parent, because that's the one that's going to make the complaint, how the parent reads this law and how much they want to push the issue. So...
Madam Chair.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you. That's an interesting point. I think the parent would be the consumer, probably, if it's depending on the age of the child, because they're probably purchasing the service. I mean, I think most parents would consider themselves the consumer with their child in that situation, but that's an interesting point. I don't think it would preclude parents from participating necessarily, because the definition of consumer is pretty broad. So, I don't know. But interesting.
Is there a definition of consumer in here?
Yes, line 12, 13, page 1. Consumer means a person who has received or is receiving mental health or addiction services.
So, in that case, the consumer would be the child, not the parent.
It would, but I guess it depends on the age and the guardianship. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, if it's a 15 or 16-year-old, that's different than a 2-year-old, so I don't know. Yeah. I think it's how parents determines their relationship with the child. That's a legal issue, probably, I would think.
Madam Chair, if I may, I would...
Representative Mallard.
If Jim Green of the OSBA came and said he does not see a problem with this bill based on the language, then that would alleviate my concern on just on that aspect. And so... You know, maybe he hasn't come to a conclusion. I don't know. I'm not trying to be disrespectful to our...
Okay, and what I'd like to do, Bob has been sitting here waiting.
I'm sorry.
And so let's hear from Bob, then we'll hear from Jim. And then, Gina, do you have any interest in testifying on this?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, all right, Bob.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junda from the Oregon Advocacy Center, and I am a lawyer. But,
like you anyway.
You just don't play one on TV.
I don't have the definitive answer to all the questions that have been raised today, other than to note that in Section 4, the Department of Human Services is given the authority to adopt rules to implement the bill, and I think in terms of defining terms that are ambiguous, determining where responsibilities lie, where there is ambiguity, that if you pass the bill as it is, it would delegate that authority to the Department of Human Services to make those calls. And so I would hope that through that process that school boards and other local agencies wouldn't be completely at sea in trying to interpret what these terms mean. I'm here to tell you that today is Road to Freedom Day here at the Capitol. And there is a bus that has been traveling across the nation that is bringing the message of disability rights and liberty across the country. It's going to be here today at the Capitol. There's going to be an event in hearing room 50 in the basement and with some speeches at 11 o'clock. Secretary of State Bradbury will be speaking, and a number of others. The message they will be bringing is tied very much to this bill, as it so happens. People with mental illness, in many cases, but not all, in many cases, are people with disabilities, and their concerns are similar, and those concerns are reflected in this bill. And one is that people with mental illness, as with other people with disabilities, strive toward full inclusion in our society. And part of full inclusion is to assure that people are not subject to unnecessary discrimination in their lives. This bill makes specific notice of a Supreme Court case, Olmstead versus LC. In that particular case, it's a hallmark case in disability rights, and it basically says that the Americans with Disabilities Act prohibits unnecessary segregation of people with disabilities, in this case meaning keeping people with disabilities in institutions like mental hospitals, facilities for the mentally retarded, and nursing homes if it isn't necessary for them to be there. And it's a message that is really under the portion of that act, the ADA, pertaining to government, saying to government, when you develop your policies in terms of where to provide services to people with disabilities, those you should, to the extent possible, integrate those services into communities rather than making people all go to the same place in the same building in order to receive their services. This bill would integrate that concept and those principles into the guiding policy of the Office of Addiction and Mental Health Services. I also wanted to point out is that federally, last year, there was a major policy paper put out by Health and Human Services, Department of Health and Human Services, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, that was developed in league with five other major federal agencies and Social Security Administration, and it calls for the transformation of the mental health system across America. And it sets forth a number of key principles. And principle number one is that our service systems need to listen to the recipients of services in developing services for those folks. And that is something that we have fallen down on in the past. And it only makes sense that if you're trying to design services that work for people, that you listen to those people in terms of what they want. And, of course, traditionally, people with mental illnesses have been discounted and considered to not be reliable reporters about how they feel about the services that they receive. And this has been recognized on a national level not to work very well. And that it's time that our services start to provide the supports, services that support recovery and integration into the community that are that help people to achieve what they hope to achieve. These are very important principles, and Senator Morissette needs a great deal of praise in bringing this forward to you, and it's worthy of being put in statute and as part of the policy of DHS, and I urge you to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Joondiff. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike, probably at you again. We talked about policy before. And Section 4, if, and I listened to what you shared, your thoughts on that you felt that this bill was valuable for committee development. Why, if you feel it is so important that this is important, do we have the word may in there to give you that opportunity to choose what you want to do rather than shall?
Chair Tomei and Representative Olson, we would be happy if it said shall or may. I understand your concern if we felt this was that important that we should advocate for it being shall instead of may. And we would support that also.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions of either of you gentlemen? Thank you both very much. Gina? Thanks for coming today.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Gina Nickel. I am the Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. There's a number of questions that have been raised today, and the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs does have an official position, and that is, of course, in support and with the amendments. The Association of Counties does not have an official position. However, they have been working on quite a few other issues, and we are in contact with them. In fact, my office is in their building, and they expect us, who work for them, to be in line on this. They know that we support this, and in fact, I have to make a report to the Association of Oregon Counties Human Services Committee at 1 o'clock about this bill. So even though they're not officially in support of and gone on record with a vote, they have been very supportive of this bill. I also want to point out that at the county level, Representative Maurer is absolutely right. The concern with the mental health and addictions committees is they're already at 51%. They go way beyond the 20% of representation. I think I would advise not to get too far afield. I don't believe that this applies to school districts in general or other committees in the broader sense. However, it's been my experience in the number of positions that I've had, if a special committee were to be formed by a school district with mental health, focused solely on mental health and addictions, school boards are really good at making sure more than 20% are on their advisory boards. The purpose of this bill was really the consumer's intent. It's to get everybody pay attention that their voice should be on these committees. And so 20%, I think, is something that we already do, and I would even put it higher, but I think as far as a policy-making decision, this makes a lot of sense. Question.
Representative Maurer, do you have any questions about unintended consequences?
No,
you are satisfied. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? Jim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. I feel like I'm at an AA meeting. I don't mean Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean Attorneys Anonymous. I am an attorney as well. And I'm going through a 12-step program to get rid of that as soon as I can, trust me. But as I look through this bill, and Representative Maurer, I always appreciate you being a former school board member. Representative Gelser, the same. Your service on those school boards was excellent. And you always catch things that I don't catch in a bill. Looking over the bill and the amendments, 174-109, if you take a look at that Section 3, and Representative Maurer, this is where you're concerned. If a school district sets up one of these committees, I stepped out in the hallway to make some quick calls, ran down to Legislative Council, pulled out the statute books. We are a public body under 174-109. And then if you take a look at the amendment, the dash A3 on line 4, it says, and subject to 192-630, that's the public meetings law. So we would be subject to both of these. I called real quickly to some folks I know who deal with this area out in the public schools. Maureen Casey, who's the superintendent of the Willamette ESD, who has a long history in special education mental health issues. I said, are you familiar with or do you know of folks in school districts who call these type of meetings together? And she said, well, yeah, we do it all the time in our individual education plans or program meetings, IEP meetings. The problem is, if you read the first part of that section on line 23, except as otherwise provided by law. Well, IEPs are driven by federal law. Who sits in those IEP meetings is very prescriptive in the Federal Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. So in the instance that she thought of automatically mental health, we know that there are prescriptions in other law which sets up what those committees are going to take a look at. She said she's not familiar with school districts setting up mental health or addiction issues on their own. What happens most times, she said, is we get drug into them. Because we happen to be where a lot of the kids are. We happen to be the community service provider in a lot of these rural towns. That's where they think of the point of delivery of services for a lot of these issues. We are generally not the instigators. I think Gina just told you that counties are the ones that generally set this up, and that's where we generally get drug into. They want to have everybody at the table that deals with families. School districts deal with families. Representative Maurer, I can't say for sure that there aren't times when school districts don't set up committees or advisory groups on mental health and addiction issues. If they would, they would be subject to this. But in most instances, it's the case where they're invited to attend those forums. And in the area dealing with mental health that we deal with in most instances, which are child with disabilities under the IDEA, the Individual Disability Education Act, it's very prescriptive on what those committees, what those IEP meetings, and who has to be invited and who needs to be there. And I know the gentleman from the Oregon Advocacy Center, Bob, and I have talked over several biennia about IEPs and special education. I hopefully he's in the back of the room nodding his head yes, that it's very prescriptive in federal law, but that as this would apply to school districts, it would be few and infrequent that we would set up these type of groups.
My questions have been more than answered, and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jim. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 364 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 16A.
Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 16A would require that all hospices not accredited by the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations to be accredited by the Oregon Hospice Association, and it would also require that all programs report data to the Oregon Hospice Association. The measure would also change the definition of an interdisciplinary team as it relates to hospice care.
Great. And we have Ann Jackson here to testify.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'm Ann Jackson. I've been the director of the Oregon Hospice Association since 1988, which was the year after Oregon's hospice laws were initially passed by the legislature, the first bill ever to be passed unanimously by both the House and the Senate. And that law required that hospices in Oregon be accredited by the Joint Commission on Healthcare Organizations, the Oregon Hospice Association, or certified as eligible to receive funding under the Medicare hospice benefit. The we are at that time in 1987. I do have handouts for you. I have a PowerPoint presentation. The Oregon Hospice Association, but it seems to, there it is over there. Excuse me, I'm sorry, all these technological things, and I'm not too sure I even really need to show this, except that it may be helpful to look at this perspective. Incidentally, about me, I have a disclaimer here that I have an MBA in not-for-profit management, so you can understand that, no, I am not an attorney, nor am I a doctor or a nurse or another clinician. I have been involved a very long time, and I'm very well qualified in this position. The first hospices in Oregon were established in 1977 along with the Oregon Hospice Association. We are a public benefit, not-for-profit organization. Our goal is to make sure that every Oregonian has excellent end-of-life care for themselves or for their families and loved ones. The first hospice was accredited in 1981, just shortly after the OHA accreditation standards were developed. A Medicare demonstration project in 1982 was passed by the federal government almost immediately afterwards, after it had been shown that hospice was a very cost-effective, compassionate way of delivering care at the end of life. As I said, in 1987, the laws were passed unanimously. In 1988, there were 43 hospices when I started. Four were Medicare certified at that time. 22 were accredited by the Oregon Hospice Association. We saw 2,000 people that year in the state of Oregon. At this time, in 2005 is the last year we have data, there were approximately 17,000 people served by Oregonians. So what this bill primarily does is, because of the growth, because of the changes, all of the many other kinds of things that are going, we need additional oversight. We are seeking to make the optional accreditation or certification required. The hospices, the provider council of the hospice, the board of directors of the Oregon Hospice Association have supported this and moved towards in developing this law. By 1990, all hospices were in compliance with the law, and by 1998, every Oregonian has access to hospice care. I wanted to, Oregon is recognized as the leader in end-of-life care, and it has been over a period of time. Part of the reason is that 9 out of 10 Americans, Oregonians, say they would prefer to die at home if they were faced with a life-threatening illness. In the United States, more than 50% of Americans die in hospitals. Oregon's hospital death rate at 22% in 2005 is among the lowest. Utah's was lower at 22% that year. Our home death rate is the highest in the nation, along with Utah as well. One of the things that we're beating Utah on, however, is the cost of care in Oregon is the lowest in the nation. Medicare pays out far less in Oregon than it does in other states, yet the satisfaction rate is the same whether that care is delivered in Oregon or elsewhere. I know you'll be looking at another bill that's talking about some of these aspects. We don't have a lot of people using general inpatient or who are dying in the hospital in Oregon, even in hospice care. It's among the lowest rate. I happen to look at that as a good thing, more so, but there, some people have indicated that perhaps Oregonians are being denied access to care in the hospitals at the end of life. They all have that option. But again, there are many people who do not want to die in a hospital. Our advanced planning rate in Oregon is the highest. Two-thirds, or 80% of Oregonians in 2002 had a living will in place, an advanced directive in place when they died. The POLST, Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, another one of the reasons Oregon is identified as a leader in end-of-life care. We developed this year. It's now being developed, adopted around the country. When a POLST is in place, wishes are respected virtually 100% of the time. And all of Oregon's hospices use the POLST form. POLST essentially convert advanced directives that are wishes into doctor's orders so that they are respected. The support studies in the mid-1990s revealed that there was zero correlation between what someone said they wanted at the end of life and what it was they got. And we heard a lot about that during the Terri Schiavo case and the many things that were going on at that time. I'm not going to talk about morphine consumption. I know that you've been dealing with a drug monitoring law. What I will say,
I'm just going to remind you, we have 9 minutes.
All right.
I'm sorry
okay,
to
I'm
rest
sorry,
you,
I
but
I'm. All right. That's just fine. And the penetration rates in hospice. What I'm really trying to get at here is this huge change in the past 5-7 years in the growth in hospice. We have so many people coming into the state of Oregon. This is one of the reasons why we need this additional oversight. We have people providing hospice who have never provided hospice before. So as good as Oregon's end-of-life care is, there still is much room for improvement. This bill, Senator Johnson was not able to be here. She's on the floor. She asked me to share her story or gave me permission to do that. But when I went to her to ask her to carry this bill for us, her mother had just recently died, and her uncle had died about 10 years earlier. And she could see the difference of the kind of care and recognize that, yes, we do need to do some additional things. Especially as we have hospices from out of the state of Oregon coming in the state. So here's what a hospice looked like in Oregon in 2003. I don't have a map to show you what it looks like in 2007.
May I interrupt real quick? I have a question on this. When you say penetration, what do you mean?
I mean the total deaths that occur in the state of Oregon against the total number of hospice deaths.
Thank you.
So hospice deaths over total deaths. And right now we're at 57, or I would guess we're well over 60% at this time. This just shows you that Morrow County was one of those that was most recent in getting it. We're very pink. But when you compare this to the United States, all of the red areas there that are coming across the lower part of the nation are getting redder. Oregon is very pink. That's very good. The blue areas really are not expanding anymore. And red is good in this and blue is bad, depending on which reds and blues you are.
Madam Chair, one quick question.
Yes, Representative Maurer.
Are there urban-rural differences because of the access to hospice?
Not in Oregon. Every Oregonian has access to hospice, regardless of where they live.
Nationally?
But nationally, indeed, there are. We have hospice in Harney County, for instance, Medicare hospice benefit, 10,000 square miles, 7,000 people, and they've had Medicare hospice benefit there for them since 1992, and it works. You look in a lot of these other areas, and the conventional wisdom says that it's not possible to do that. In Oregon, we've been able to do it.
Ms. Jackson, since we've only got about 6 minutes left,
yes.
Why don't we get down to what the bill actually does?
Okay, well, the bill actually makes the accreditation and certification mandatory, as I indicated. There are a couple of other things that it does. It establishes that hospice is an institution for purposes of ORS 146. This is the law regarding death investigations. Hospice deaths should not need to be investigated. This is a waste of time. And yet, if you look at the Oregon map, we'll see that many counties interpret that differently. And we've actually had times where the county sheriff of an area has gone in to investigate the death of a hospice person, which is not appropriate. Mm-hmm. Now, 146.100 indicates that with those people who have been admitted into a hospital or an institution for less than 24 hours, those deaths would need to be reported. This qualifies hospice as that. Every single hospice has an attendant. Patient has an attending physician. Their care is monitored. People are in their homes frequently. If there is any problem, if the death is suspicious, certainly a hospice would be required to report that. The second aspect of this expands the interdisciplinary team to meet Medicare requirements, allowing nurse practitioners and ultimately physician assistants in Oregon that are moving forward who could conceivably be attending physicians, four hospice patients, and adds nurse practitioners to the interdisciplinary team.
Thank you for your testimony. I just had a quick question. The use of the word patients in line 17, it wouldn't preclude someone from having an attending physician that's not... I guess I'm curious why patients is in there. Patients with an apostrophe. Yeah. Here's the situation. Yes, because I've had situations where someone doesn't want someone who had been their attending physician to be there. They want the hospice physician to be their team leader. So that would not preclude that from...
No. That way the patient... This would actually establish that it's going to be the patient's attending physician. An attending physician could be changed.
Okay.
Definition. So this is incorporating those concerns.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Maurer.
Quickly. So... If a nurse practitioner is a primary care provider, is it federal law that says that they can't sign hospice orders?
Or they can. The Medicare hospice benefit, or the Medicare management, the law that was passed in 2003 regarding Medicare Part D that updated Medicare, added to the definition of attending physician for the purpose of hospice care nurse practitioners.
Okay. And so this law now...
This now incorporates that as well, establishes that.
Okay, because up until now, it had to be a physician.
Yes, but it's more just a housekeeping kind of a measure. It wasn't precluding nurse practitioners from being attending physicians.
It's not a housekeeping issue when you have patients and there is no physician involved.
Absolutely. Well, the nurse practitioners have been allowed to practice under this. We just are adding it to make sure.
Follow-up, Representative.
That's not been our experience, that nurse practitioners were allowed, that there had to be a physician signing. So.
Not for hospice. Now, they do for other Medicare kinds of things. The Medicare hospice benefit allows the nurse practitioner. Representative Moore, I'm sorry, I'm hurrying and I'm following protocol. I apologize.
Anyway, but this clears that up.
This clears it up.
Then we'll go.
The next aspect of this bill would be to, when this bill was established, it was unlikely to have licensure passed. There is no fiscal cost to this bill. The Oregon Hospice Association hospices are covering the costs of these. So we do not have formal licensure. Hospices are regulated in the state of Oregon. It's been a very successful model. It's now finally being looked at by other states. But what this law does is establish the equivalency of licensure for people, for agencies who comply with this law and are accredited and certified. This way, when other states are looking and saying, well, Oregon doesn't have licensure, that we can say, yes, they do. And we have talked with the Health Division's licensure department about that, and they agree with this. And then the final aspects of this are to establish statutorily that hospices are to provide data to the Oregon Hospice Association and that we will submit that data. We have been collecting data in 1988. The 1987 law, incidentally, and I didn't make this clear, does authorize the Oregon Hospice Association as an accrediting body for hospices and also gives us responsibility to keep the registry on behalf of hospices and to have some responsibilities in ensuring compliance with the law.
Any questions? Quick questions. Okay, thank you so much. And I'm going to ask a question of this committee. I'm not ready to pass this out. Representative Olson has some questions. And I'm wondering if we need to ask this witness to come back or if we can discuss this on our own. Do we need more information from this witness? You're from Multnomah County, is that correct?
I am.
Madam Chair, I'm very supportive of this bill and would be happy to do any research that is associated with questions.
Great. So are you saying you don't need to have this witness return?
No, ma'am. I kind of wish she had testified in front of the health care committee as at least information. This is very interesting.
Madam Chair, I think there's enough information in her letter that we probably...
Yeah.
A lot is in here, so I think probably once we have a chance to read it, we'll have
So we didn't need to bring this witness back for anybody? Thank you so much, Ms. Jackson. Sorry we weren't able to give you more time, but we will certainly give this our serious consideration and deal with it soon in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 16A, and I will close the meeting on House Committee on Human Services.